ABC AFL Daily is the best conversation in footy. Hosted by Corbin Middlemass and Ben Cameron, alongside regulars like Mick Malthouse.
I mean, I don't remember too many games, but it's one of the ones I remembered. It was just that physical.
Bob Murphy.
Where do you guys get off thinking you can pick and choose?
And more, it keeps you in the loop with the biggest stories in the AFL and the number one analysis in the game. ABC AFL Daily, 5 eps a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Kubasi taking aim. Oh, spilled by Lemons and buried. It's that man again. And Spain take the lead late on. Mikel Merino climbing off the bench once again. And we have our Hollywood headline.
Hollywood, all right. What kind of movie might depend on your perspective? Belgians will see it as a tragedy. A golden generation hobbled by injury, many on the bench and forced to watch on as their dream ended. If you're Spanish, it was a feel-good thriller. They roll on to France. We're covering that with Mark Schwarzer in a moment. While Norway has been the story of the tournament, we're crossing to Oslo to our woman on the ground to understand how they've captured the hearts of a nation and why a country of 5.6 million is kicking ass in so many sports, not just football. I'm Patrick Stack. This is ABC Sport Daily World Cup Special. Spain is into the final four. They just beat Belgium. They next face France. What a cracker that's going to be. Mark Schwartz is here to talk about the lot. Mark, a really fun and open game. Spain had the lion's share of possession and chances. Belgium pushed them in moments. But was it just as simple as Spain having too much quality in the end?
I think certainly the quality was there from Spain. There's no doubt about it. Belgium also have it. I felt for Belgium losing Tielemann in the warm-up. That was a massive loss through the game. They lost Courtois. They lost De Bruyne. I mean, these are three top class players, really important players for Belgium. And ultimately, that I think in the end is what cost them. If you're going to have a chance against Spain, you've got to have your strongest possible team on the park to go up against them. And unfortunately for Belgium, it just wasn't meant to be today.
The largest talking point was around the deciding goal. Belgian keeper Thibaut Courtois leaving the field in injury, in tears.
Oh, now then, there is going to be a change after all. And Thibaut Courtois, well, he gave it a go, but he can't continue. So Courtois leaves us. Oh, that is not a sight that we want to see. Thibaut Courtois in tears.
A legend of Belgian football, who was out of the team not that long ago, brought back in under the new manager, Rudy Garcia. The veteran Real Madrid keeper goes off. His replacement spills a shot, which is turned in. Mark, it was agonising.
Yeah, it was. Look, I felt for all of them. Obviously, for Thibaut Courtois to go off in any game, let alone a World Cup quarterfinal, it's heartbreaking. Lemons, I feel for him. It's a hard one. Coming off the bench in those moments, such an important game, crucial moments. It's a shot. It's an awkward shot. Yes, he should hold it. Yes, he should deal with it 100%. 99% of the time he does. And unfortunately, in the moment he doesn't, they get punished for it. You often see it, goalkeeper coming in and just not quite being up to speed, not quite being having his eye in. And how is he going to? So it's very, very difficult. And I feel for Lemons, I feel for Courtois, and I feel for Belgium in that instance.
Is that the end of the road for Courtois? You know him oh so well. I'm sure he'll continue at club level, but internationally?
I don't think necessarily it is. Look, he's a top-class goalkeeper. He's 34 years old. There's absolutely no reason why he can't continue. It really comes down to him. He's still playing at the very highest level. He's playing for one of, if not the biggest club in the world in Real Madrid. So there's no reason whatsoever in my eyes that he can't continue. It's all about him. What desire, what hunger does he still have to play for his national team? Is this the moment where he feels like it's enough's enough? Or will he continue at least to the Euros, which I think is more than feasible?
Belgium's golden generation. You know, it was believed that at their peak, this group was a team, a bunch of players that could win something, a Euros, a World Cup even. Like, I know they have not done so here, but was this tournament one where they kind of had something of a moment? While maybe the expectation wasn't there, but we saw them at times at least put their best foot forward.
I think certainly in the previous round of 16, against the USA. I thought that's where they performed really, really well. I thought that was their best performance in the tournament thus far. That was a moment where I felt like, okay, they're starting to come into form now. They're playing at their peak. And especially then obviously having this game against Spain, you had to play well. Spain is a top class team, one of the favorites of the tournament. They had to play exceptionally well to beat Spain.
And the cross was a disappointing one, but a chance for Belgium to build again. De Bruyne back out to Castagne, into to Català! Belgium equaliser!
They pushed them, and unfortunately, I just feel like for this generation, certainly for the De Bruyne, Lukaku and the likes, it's just that little bit too long. A fitter, younger De Bruyne would have made a bigger difference, of course. I mean, because he was a phenomenal player. And I feel for Belgium in this instance that it's just, I think, a couple of years too long for this generation of players.
It's agonizing then that it kind of comes down to, for this generation, I don't know if error's too strong a word, but a goalkeeping moment deep in regular time against a Spanish side that is an absolute heavyweight.
Look, I think any moment you lose a game, and even more so when it's an individual that is directly at fault for it. Look, I mean, of course, Lemons will hold his hands up and, you know, acknowledge that he made a mistake, couldn't hold on to it. Look, I'm sure his teammates will rally around him. It's just one of those things that, unfortunately, we've often said, I've talked about it so many times in my career, is that, you know, the goalkeeping position is brutal. You know, you've got very little room to hide. You can very rarely make mistakes. You make mistakes, it generally leads to a goal. Other positions on the park are so much more forgiving. That's just the nature of being a goalkeeper. So he's going to learn from it. He's been brilliant this season at Manchester United since he's made that move, that step up. This is going to be a really tough learning curve for him. But I still believe he'll go on and become a top-class goalkeeper.
Lamine Yamal, he warmed into this game. At the outset of this tournament, we've talked about, you know, Messi, Haaland, Harry Kane, these players and their propensity to take ownership, take over a Football World Cup. And I think we've seen it from those three guys and, of course, Kylian Mbappe. Lamine Yamal, we've seen glimpses. He came into the tournament under an injury cloud. There were times where it felt like he was going to take this game by the scruff of the neck and give us a moment. But do you feel like we're watching a switch being flicked in real time?
I think he's very close to that, isn't he? I mean, today was definitely his best performance so far at this tournament. You're right, coming in with an injury cloud, not being 100% fit, not starting him certainly in the opening game, possibly cost them the win, but doesn't mean anything because they're in the semi-final now anyway. And it's about making sure you manage your players, certainly your big players like Lamine Yamal, and making sure that he is fit for latter stages of the tournament. Of course, there is a risk involved. However, with Spain, the squad of players that they have, you always felt that they were going to go quite far in this tournament. So it seems to be that it's paying off really well right now. They've got a pretty fit squad. They've got no real worries in terms of injuries. And therefore, it's all about now how they manage this team going forward.
Yamal, Porro again, Doko's with him. There's the pullback. Good save, spelled goal. Fabian Ruiz.
They're in the semi-final. They're going to have their toughest game of the tournament against France, who I think are probably, they're certainly for me, my number one favourite for winning the tournament, and then closely followed by Spain. So that game is like setting up to be a phenomenal game. I almost feel like it's a winner's take all semi-final. Obviously there's other teams in the tournament still and they'll have a lot to say, and the final is the final, whichever one of the two get there. But Spain are well positioned and Lamine Yamal is heading in that right direction. I will say that today there's a couple of times where he got a little bit predictable. Yes, trickery, pace on the ball, but so often cut inside, back onto his left, and was red. The situation was red too easily. And again, I think against France, that's going to be even tougher for him. So he's just got to mix it up a little bit. But I mean, we started to really see Lamine Yamal at his best.
What else did you see from Spain that you felt would trouble France, who you see as the benchmark right now?
Look, I think the battle for me is in midfield with whether it's Fabian Ruiz and Rodri, or it's Pedri and Rodri. I think that anchor, that those two setups are really, really strong. The way in which they complement, support, whether it's Danny Elmar in the number 10 role, Lamine Yamal in particular. We saw Nico Williams come on today as well. He's someone that we've seen very little of so far in this tournament. You see the way Spain set up. Obviously, they're setting out with a 4-2-3-1. And at times, they're like literally a 4-2-4. And that's how they're attacking a lot of the times. So it'll work twofold. Against France, it's going to be difficult because at times you've got to be so careful on the counterattack because France have got the ability with their pace, with their front four, which I think is player for player a better front four than Spain do. But it sets itself up for a really intriguing battle.
Charles de Ketelaar finds a crack in the Spanish armour. Unai Simon finally beaten.
I think the battle is going to be won in that midfield positions. Who can control the midfield better? I do like the way Spain look in midfield. And then it's all about then who can defend the best against the two different attacking options that both sides possess. I just fancy France have a little bit more going forward than Spain do.
Two corkers on Sunday Australian time, Norway v England, Argentina v Switzerland. Mark Schwartz is going to be back to cover both. Just before you go, Mark, have you got a tip for each?
Oh, gosh, it's so difficult to call. You know, look, on paper, England, I think, are favourites over Norway. Norway done tremendously well. Erling Haaland, obviously one of the best strikers on the planet against another, probably the best striker on the planet in Harry Kane. The conditions are tough. It's very hot, very humid. I just feel that England have that little bit more over Norway. But look, Norway's knocked Brazil out. And it could be a fairy tale. It could be one of those tournaments where Norway go all the way to the semi-final at the very least. But I'm gonna go more with my heart and think England are going to have a better... I'm feeling like England are going to win this game. And I think they're going to win 2-1. And then you look at Argentina. I think that's a really intriguing battle against Switzerland. Switzerland have got some really exciting players. They're a different team, the team that Argentina haven't come up across yet so far in this tournament. They've got a technical ability up front. Mbolo is a real powerful runner, really good striker up front. Obviously, you've got Granit Xhaka, who's probably in the best form of his career still. And I think defensively, Switzerland are pretty strong. They're going to have to be against Argentina. We've seen Argentina going forward are phenomenal. Defensively, they've got problems. They're susceptible to counterattacks. And that's what we've seen in the last two rounds for Argentina. The pressure on their shoulders, once again, is enormous. They're overwhelming favourites to beat Switzerland. I'm going to say they're going to get through, but it's going to be tight. I'm going to say it's going to be I'm going to say it's a 2-1 to Argentina.
Mark Schwartzer, appreciate your time. We'll catch you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Norway has been the vibe team of this Football World Cup. Erling Haaland banging in goals, making gags. Martin Odegaard bossing it in midfield. Fans rowing the Viking boat in stadiums, on trains, Times Square, the streets of Oslo. Take your pick. Mina Finstad-Berg is a sports and football commentator on TV2 in Norway. Hello, Mina.
Hi, how are you?
I'm really good. I don't think anyone's better than your nation right now, though. The feel-good story of the Football World Cup. You know, I've seen the vision of the celebrations on the streets in your nation. What has the atmosphere been like in Norway?
I mean, it's beyond anything I could have imagined in my wildest imagination, my wildest fantasies. Like, after the game when we beat Brazil, I was up by the Royal Castle with what felt like 100,000 of my closest friends, because like the atmosphere was just like everyone was best friends. Everyone was so happy. It was this huge euphoria. I've never seen anything like it. I've never in my life seen so many people. And this is a story you couldn't have written because it's so unexpected. And everyone is just having the time of their life. It's like all of Norway are trying to make up for 28 years of not being part of the World Cup or the Euros. So we want to do it all at once. So it's insane.
Am I right in saying the national football team isn't always so universally loved in Norway? And if so, why is the energy around this group so different, aside from the fact that you're winning lots of games and scoring lots of goals?
Well, To be honest, I think the winning part is a big part of it, because the national team was also loved in the 90s when I was a kid, when they were going to the World Cups and the Euros, and they were beating Brazil back in the 90s as well. But I think that for a lot of Norwegians, it's been almost like a defense mechanism, not giving your heart fully to the national team because you know they would break it. Because they had this habit of always kind of stumbling when it really, really counted, or always find some way to lose the most important games, to find some way of screwing up, even when they had potential, even when they had games that were totally winnable. So I think for a lot of people, you needed this kind of ironical distance to the national team, because if you got too emotionally involved, you just knew that they would eventually crush your dreams and hopes and heart. So we didn't really let ourselves love them fully and completely. We didn't really let ourselves get totally lost in the national team. But now we have a national team who, they feel like a team, like a real, real proper football team, not just individuals, not just us. They have this lovable energy about them. And they have a coach that's really, really highly thought of in Norway, Ståle Solbakken. We waited for him for a lot of years that he would finally be available for the national team. And he has also opened up the door to the national team. He's very honest when he speaks in his press conferences. He talks really honestly about what kind of players he's looking for, the strengths and weaknesses of different players. And while other coaches and other like leaders in the world of sports, they tend to keep their cards really close to their chest and they don't want to talk too much. They sound more like politicians than, you know, coaches. He's been the complete opposite. He's been really honest and he's given really good answers at all his press conferences. And I think that also makes the national team more of a common national project. We are all invited in. We get to hear how he thinks, what's his reasons, what's his arguments. So he's been very open. But of course, I think it's a lot of really, really good football players, and they have been winning, and they've been winning in a really lovable way, in a fun way. And of course, you have Erling Braut Haaland, the biggest star of them all, but also the one who seems to enjoy it the most. And he has all of a sudden changed kind of how he presents himself and how he approaches the media. So he's also way more open now than he used to be. And I think that helps as well. He's more like, we call it frikkelig in Norwegian. I can't really remember the English word for it right now, but it's more like he has this kind of man of the people thing about him, which really, really resonates with the Norwegian population and the world, it looks like.
Erling Haaland, yes, let's steer into that. You guys obviously know him so well, and we all knew that he was great at football, but the world has kind of fallen in love with him as a character as well. Just how big and beloved is he in Norway?
I mean, I think this World Cup is also really making all of Norway fall in love with him in a way they weren't before, because he has been a little bit more like a machine, like a robot, a little bit almost grumpy from time to time when he does like interviews with the media and stuff like that. A couple of years ago, he felt, when he first got his big breakthrough, he was this kid having fun, scoring for fun, smiling and joking around. But then he started becoming a star, and he became more like this polished goal machine, and he kind of closed off a bit, and he seemed very unapproachable. But this summer, the last year, he's really opened up and he's kind of inviting the world in to see the more fun parts and goofy parts of his personality. And I think that's, for him, like as a strategy, PR or strategy, is genius, because when he's being his, you know, goofy self on Snapchat, on Instagram, in interviews, on the pitch, I mean, it's so lovable, and it's so much fun to watch that people, they are drawn to it in a way that's almost magnetic, I think.
If Norway get to the quarterfinals, I'll go on the River Mersey and I'll roll down it.
Okay, you heard that here first.
Wayne Rooney, I expect you to go out on a rowing trip.
So I'm looking forward to see you, Wayne boy.
The old goal-scoring record for the Norwegian national team, it was 33 goals, and it stood for 90 years. Haaland smashed it in 2024, and he's almost doubled it by now. So, I mean, just when you look at what he has done in that Norway shirt, it's impossible for the Norwegian people not to love him.
It's an astonishing record. Could you tell us a little bit about his pedigree? Should we have almost sort of seen this coming? Because I think a lot of Australians wouldn't appreciate the lineage of Haaland.
Well, I mean, his father was, of course, a professional football player himself, Alf-Inge Haaland, who played in the Premier League, played for the national team, played in the World Cup. His mom was also an athlete, and people who have seen them both credit her for like his speed and his ability to jump, stuff like that. Cause she was a heptathlete. What's the English word?
Yeah,
sounds like that. Yeah. So a lot of people credit like his ability to jump and his speed to her. And of course, he has been guided by his father since he was a kid. And that's, of course, a big, big, big advantage to have a father who knows the ins and outs of the footballing world. And they have been super, super smart with all the moves in his career. They kind of always seem to take the right step at the right time. When they went to Molde, where he had a big breakthrough in the Norwegian League, and then they went to RB Salzburg, where he got a lot of playing time. He got to play in the Champions League, scored a hat-trick, of course, in his debut, as he does. And then with Borussia Dortmund, where he also got to play a lot, and he got to play in a big league, in big matches in the Champions League. And, of course, it go to City to work under Pep Guardiola. So they have this knack of just timing and choosing the right path for him every time they are facing a difficult choice. And I think that's because he comes from a footballing family. And also he did a lot of different sports, as many Norwegian kids do. Personally, I think that's a strength, that we encourage the kids in Norway to not just find your sport when you're like 6 years old and that's what you're going to do for the rest of your childhood and teenage years, and then maybe you go pro. But that you are encouraged to, well, you can play handball, you can play football, you can go cross-country skiing during the winter, or like Ørjan Nyland, the goalkeeper, he did alpine skiing. Alexander Sørloth, our other striker, he did football, but he also did handball, and he did speed skating. So a lot of our footballers have also done other kind of sports when they were young. And I think that teaches your body to move in different ways. And you get to learn how to use your body in different kinds of sports in different ways. How you think about movement and sports in different kind of sports. And I think that's a strength, to not encourage the kids to choose football when they're five and then don't do anything else. So I think that's a part of it as well.
It's really interesting to hear you talk to that, because during the Winter Olympics, when your nation was winning absolutely everything, I started reading up on the Norwegian attitude to sport. You're only a nation of 5.6 million. The Winter Games, football, track and field, tennis, golf, I just keep seeing Norwegians kicking ass on the world stage. And like, how central is sport to life in Norway? And can you maybe tell us about the participation mentality that I think is very different to some other nations?
Yeah, I mean, sports is a pillar in our society, really. We are calling like the Norwegian sports movement is the biggest people's movement in Norway. When you look at the memberships and how many Norwegians are doing some kind of organized sports, I don't remember the exact numbers right now. I think it's sort of like 1.9 million members of the Norwegian Sports Federation. And it's like democratically governed. And it's like Norwegian football, we don't have private owners, not even in Eliteserien, in our top division. They are member owned clubs. So it's like Norwegian sport it's huge. And one of the most important slogans is that they want to have as many as possible, the best way as possible, but also for as long as possible. So it is one of the big main goals of the Norwegian sports movement to have as many people as possible participating in sports, but also have them participate as long as possible. So you want to keep the 15-year-old that's never going to be a top athlete, he's never going to play professional football, but you want to keep him in the sport, and you want to have different levels of participating for different people with different talents. And that's really, really important. And if you have a really, really high participation rate, of course, the chances of finding unique talent is biggie, you know. I saw this survey a couple of years ago saying that when they looked at teenagers in Norway, more than 90% of them had been involved in organized sport at some point in their childhood or teenage years. So it's like almost every Norwegian kid at some point will be part of organized sports. And that's a huge advantage. It's important, of course, for finding talent, developing talent, and getting the gold at the Olympics and all that kind of stuff. But it's also super, super important for the society, for like the public health of Norway, for mental health, for like integration, for all these other parts of society that also benefits from having a strong sports movement and having a lot of people participating in the sports movement.
That's an incredible statistic. I reckon the only thing in terms of participation that's higher maybe in Norway right now is the Viking row. That feels like 100% participation.
Yeah, I mean, but that's mandatory. They'll take your passport if you don't join in. So, you know.
Am I right in saying, though, that that's a relatively new thing? Like that this hasn't always been?
Yeah.
Like how has that come to pass? It's quite incredible that they've been able to just generate that.
Well, the Oljeberget, which is the Norwegian like supporter club for the national team, they introduced it, I think it was in March, for the friendly game at Ullevål back then. And it came with this kind of, they tried to make this World Cup song with this quite well-known Norwegian artist. And it was part of the like lyrics there. It was, we're going to row, row, row. So it was kind of a gimmick. And they did it at Ullevål. I think it was against Switzerland in March. And people thought it was fun. But then all of a sudden it just took off. And I think the reason it works so well is that it's so easy to join in. You don't need to know the lyrics and it's very easy to do. Everyone can do it. You don't need like to play an instrument or anything like that. And it's something different. Yeah, it reminds you a little bit about the Icelandic clapping from 10 years ago. But still, it feels fresh. It feels new. And it's something different, and the visual, of course, is super cool in the stadium. And then, but then all of a sudden, people started doing it outside the stadiums and in Times Square and in kindergartens and in nursing homes and just in the middle of the road at middle of night. And I mean, even our crown prince came out from the Royal Castle after the game against Brazil and joined in the rowing with all the supporters in front of the palace. And I mean, come on, that's just crazy.
And it's not just Norwegians rowing with this team. I think unless you are English, every neutral is behind. Like you've got the collective football community behind you. Is there a sense that they can actually win this Football World Cup? Like, are they daring to dream?
Well, I mean, like, if you look at the odds, Norway's probably not going to win the World Cup. I mean, we're probably, if you look at the odds, going to lose to England, which have, the English team, they have so much more tournament experience together. And it's Premier League players and Bundesliga players. It's like top players all over the field. So, I mean, the most probable thing is that England is going to beat Norway, but that Norway will make it a difficult task for them. But this team has given us the right to dream about another miracle. And I think that as long as Erling Braut Haaland plays, no one really dare to write Norway completely off. Because he is scoring, I mean, he has more goals than games for Norway. and that's just like ridiculous. He now has as many national team goals as Zlatan Ibrahimovic in his entire career had for Sweden.
That's, I love that. You're just twisting the knife across the Scandinavian divide there. I like that.
that wasn't on purpose, I promise. But yeah, but it just, because Zlatan is huge in Scandinavia, it's huge all over the world, of course. So it just speaks to the craziness of what Erling Braut Haaland is doing and has been doing for quite a long time now. And he is almost always scoring whenever he enters the grass for Norway. And I mean, no offense, but it doesn't look like an impossible test to score against this England defense with injuries and stuff. So we're a little bit lucky with facing England when they have injuries to key players in defense. But the problem is that England has Harry Kane, who also scores every time he plays a match. So, I mean, I think that both teams are probably going to score. And the most probable thing is that England wins. But, I mean, it's not impossible. I'm giving Norway a fair chance, even though I personally believe that the quarterfinal is where the fairy tale of the summer 2026 will end.
We're all behind the Norwegian experience. We're enjoying it a lot from distance. Mina, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no worries. It's fun. I mean, I've never had people from all around the world wanting to talk about the Norwegian national team before, so it's a new experience, but I'm liking it.
Let me say it again for those in the back. How good has this World Cup been? That episode was produced by Declan Byrne. Thanks to SBS and the BBC for the extra audio used in this episode. See you tomorrow.